We should talk a little bit about what we're going to do first, probably.
Talk about books.
Mm. That's what we do every week.
If only we could take our love of reading to a new level.
Well, I've always wanted to start a book club.
Book club!
For
Masochists and Other Deviants.
Hello and welcome to the Book Club for Masochists, where we read and discuss all the books, regardless of our actual interest in them. This time we have a special episode. We are talking about Indigenous First Nations and Aboriginal literature. It wasn't necessarily fiction, was it?
Books.
There we go. But this is actually a special episode in that we are re-recording this many, many months after the fact because we had some technical issues with the first recording. So we're all a little rusty on what it was we discussed and read. I don't remember my book quite as well as I would think.
I have some notes.
Yes. You know, we all re-listened to that rather scrambled previous recording.
Speak for yourself.
Okay.
I wrote notes some for Amanda to read.
Thanks. We're taking care of each other. Look at each other.
We try. So I think it's really important that we do mention, like, none of us are experts in this topic whatsoever at all. And if we look around the room, we are really white in this room, so we are really not representative of these communities in any ways. But we are trying to have a conversation about what it's like to do some exploration and thinking.
And just be a bit better about reading into the topic and into the issues.
So. Yeah. And about intentionality in reading, you know.
And if we've made any major mistakes, please let us know.
We welcome any kind of feedback.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I guess how we usually start is with what's our familiarity with this area.
No, how we usually start is introducing who we are.
Who are
I'm
we?
I'm Matthew. I'm a librarian.
I'm Megan. I'm a public librarian / archivist / magpie reader.
I'm Amanda, and I'm also a librarian.
And I'm Anna, and also a librarian.
How strange that we would all find ourselves here in the same room.
So weird. Okay, so once we've gotten that out of the way, now the first thing we talk about is
our background with the topic?
Topic. Yeah. It's definitely a genre. It's not even a topic.
I'm actually so glad we're re-recording this because the first time we did it, I was just like, I've read some stuff, but I actually looked up some of the books that I have previously read and I wrote them down, so I'll start. A lot of my previous reading this genre was stuff I read in grade school, accidentally, not because I was like seeking out, you know, books with the First Nations characters or whatever, but I wrote down a few of them that I read in school that I can remember, which was Walk Two Moons by Sharon Creech. Island of the Blue Dolphins by Scott Odell.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite books.
Yeah.
Is it not just about dolphins?
Not just about dolphins.
I am really indicating my maleness here, I think.
Yeah, actually, that may be true. This is definitely a major reading experience for young girls of a certain time period.
I'm trying to think of male Indigenous characters and coming up blank, but that just may be my reading biases coming out.
Well, this would affirm that theory, because the next one I wrote down was Morning Girl by Michael Doris, and then I had also previously read a bunch of Sherman Alexie, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, which does have a young boy as one of the main characters, and then The Lone Ranger and Tonto, Fistfight in Heaven.
If I go way, way, way back, I spent a couple months in an Inuit community called Kudjuak when I was 4. And one of the things that came out of that was a bilingual comic book called Super Shamu, which was based on a short-lived TV series of the same name, the creators of which were Barney Petinguyak and Peter Tepate, who was also played the main character Super Shamu in it, and then it was turned into a comic by Nick Burns in 1989.
Super Shamu is an utterly adorable name.
Did you watch it?
No.
No, oh, okay.
No, I've not. Yeah, I've never heard of it before.
What happens in Super Shamu?
Well, he's kind of like public safety announcements. He's a superhero and he has all the kind of superhero powers you might expect someone like Superman to have, but he's also really much based within the Inuit context. There's a short YouTube clip of the show in which he reminds boys not to go out into the water without life jackets.
Awesome.
Show notes.
Yeah. Really?
Already just boys? Girls can go out without life jackets?
Yes.
Or girls are naturally better swimmers, you know.
Girls are assumed to be smart enough to know not to go out.
I thought they were had, like, natural flotation properties.
Well, based on the fact that... Based on the fact that I definitely sink when I go into water, that makes sense to me.
It's just because you have, so do I, so...
That's because you have, like, zero body fat index, so, like...
It's the truth.
Women naturally have innate flotation properties.
That's a great statement.
I also read a lot of, like, kids' books, along with, like, Wachtumans and all that. Was Elizabeth George wrote a couple, like, Beauty of the Wolves, which is a... I think she's Alaskan, actually. Alaskan native. What was the other one? Talking Earth, I was really in love with. That was my background.
I am one of those people who really does not remember what I read as a child very well. Like, sometimes people will say, I read this thing. I'm like, oh yeah, I think I did read that too. I don't know. I don't know what I read as a kid. There were a few picture books that I remember reading and particularly loving that were about various communities of, well, I'm from the U.S., so primarily I was reading about American natives who in the United States.
Yeah.
And I remember enjoying those a lot, but I don't remember which ones I read. I could probably do a bunch of research and figure it out. I don't know. My mother, however, is a teacher, and she specifically has a focus in reading. And for a few years, she was hired by the state of Alaska to go around to various small communities. And, yeah, I mean, boy, these are small, small communities. And and she would... She would work with the little schools there, specifically around reading education. But it meant she spent a lot of time going around to many, many different little communities in the middle of nowhere. And so she would talk a lot about the education issues in those communities and the lack of reading materials that reflected their own languages or reflected them within mm-hmm. the materials. So they weren't reading about themselves. They were reading about basically Caucasian Western culture.
Yeah.
So she would talk about those things, and I was aware of the issues, but I didn't really read that specifically into it.
Yeah. It's interesting. One of my aunts is a principal, and when I was visiting, she talked a little bit about when she was in Haida Gwaii, the kids reading Monkey Beach by Eden Robinson, and how all the Native kids, like, a lot of the context within the story was immediately relevant to them. And then a lot of the white kids, like, didn't have that background. And so mm-hmm. being able to engage the story was a little bit more difficult without that context. And so what must be like to have that reversed? And mm-hmm. so you're reading all these texts that don't seem to have anything to do with your life and your background.
I read some, I will say... comics with questionable accuracy as a child. Mm-hmm. There was Little Plum, I believe, which is probably super racist and probably still comes out, to be totally honest. It was like a one-page strip in like the Beano or something, which is a UK weekly children's humor comic. And I also read Tintin in America.
Ooh.
Which had some like American, quote unquote, American Indians in it. Mm-hmm. Though at least it did portray them as being screwed over by the government. Mm-hmm. And I also read Scalped by Jason Aaron and a number of artists, which is actually really good. It's a lot more recent. It's probably one of my favorite comic series. It's very bleak and depressing. It's set mm-hmm. on a First Nations reserve in Dakota or somewhere in the U.S. It's very good. It's very violent and upsetting.
Yeah, the other thing I find interesting about, in terms of a background for this topic was when I was growing up, who was the indigenous peoples within the area that I was growing up, who actually originally had been there. So being from Alaska, it was various Alaska Native groups, and then coming here to Vancouver and getting a completely different perspective, not only on who were the groups that were here, but how the community in the communities and nations around Vancouver interacted with the city of Vancouver. And it's very different around Vancouver than I gather than what it is anywhere else in Canada, but also certainly different from what it was like in Alaska. Though I would say I've lived in Alaska, Oregon, Minnesota, and here. Mm-hmm. And of those places, Alaska and Vancouver, while I was there, I actually dealt with these issues and thought about and had engagements on these issues, and nothing when I was in Minnesota and Oregon. Yeah. And it doesn't mean it wasn't there. It's just not in the circles I was.
Sometimes I wonder if it was like place or time, because I felt like I got very little after like fur trading kind of thing in my education. But one of my colleagues was teaching like a sensitization course or something in one of the cégeps back in Montreal, and she said that some of the people in her class had never heard of residential schools.
Yes. Oh dear. I just had a conversation with a fellow librarian recently who had never heard of the 60s scoop.
I have no idea what that is.
The 60s scoop is when babies in particular, children, but babies in particular, were taken away from their First Nations, Métis, and Aboriginal mothers at birth because they were considered unfit to care for these children. They were basically talked into signing away the rights to their kids. And then those children were replaced with white families, and they still cannot get the records of who their original, in many places, get the records of who their original parents were. They can't get access to who they are and where they come from and what their traditions and their backgrounds are. And it's not enough to say you're Aboriginal. Mm-hmm. Like, you're from a particular community.
That,
you have a history.
Discussion on, like, place and time, I think, brings up a really interesting point for this topic and for this month, which is that, you know, Indigenous, Aboriginal, Métis, First Nations literature or books, it's not like this homogeneous, like, oh, you can go to like that section and they're all the same. It's like there's so many different formats, there's so many different like communities and tribes or bands or, you know, geographical areas that people come from with different customs and traditions and names and languages.
You can't just smooth them all together as if it's one thing.
Are you sure?
Isn't that one of the criticisms of J.K. Rowling and her Magic in North America book?
And Africa, I believe.
Oh, did you do that too?
Following this
I am specifically not following that.
What?
That whole discussion.
You're an otherwise like grand fan of
I'm a huge fan of Harry Potter, but I am not a huge fan of content that's being added to the series after the series finished. I feel I want to stay, what's the word I'm thinking of?
Pure.
Canon. I like the original canon.
Mm. Yeah.
I lost my train of thought. That's one of the things of, like, being a fan. You have the right to select
how you will interact. This far, no further.
This far, no further.
Yeah.
So I just thought that was a really important point to bring up, and it's kind of similar to every single discussion we have every month about how the genre, we get the genre creep, it goes off into different areas, it's got these subgenres, and it always, every single month we find that it's more complex than we originally thought it was, right?
Yes.
Which is, like, with this is certainly true. I mean, this is in no way a genre, and this covers potentially any genre. So it's a odd little limitation, but it's allowed us to read into some things that we wouldn't necessarily usually read into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
For sure, yeah. But it still did bring up some, like, weird genre creep things. Like, the big one, I think, this month was figuring out if your author is actually Aboriginal or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that could be tricky.
You don't want to make assumptions based on name or based on a picture on the back. There's many people who claim First Nations or Aboriginal ancestry who look, you know, to the eye, someone looking at them might look white, right? And so you can't just look at a picture on a book, you can't just look at the name, and, you know, maybe it'll say something in the description, but maybe not. But we were finding that a lot of the books, at least when we originally recorded this podcast, many of the books seemed as though they had been written by white authors, right? One of the books I mentioned was written by a French journalist, right, for example. So that's one difficulty. How do you find books written by those actual communities?
Yeah, that wasn't a problem I was super aware of until I took a folklore and storytelling course in which you had to read a book. So I picked one, and it was about a First Nations legend, Iktomi and the Ducks. And it was only after that I realized that it was this whole series of books that this white guy had rewritten for, like, North American audiences.
I actually dealt with an interesting kind of example of this recently. I was editing a review of a graphic novel for, the review was for our website, and it was about I can't remember his name, the first, like, African-American explorer to the Arctic.
Oh.
Do you remember? He was going up there with, like, going to the North Pole with the first guy that went up there. So it talked about the Aboriginal people that they were interacting with in, I guess, Greenland.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just made up a legend.
What?
Literally just made up a legend. I could find no other reference to this. I talked to the reviewer. They also could find no other reference to this anywhere. And the writer, who was from Germany, I think, had just been like, this fits in with my plot and the story that I want to tell. So I'll just make this up and attribute it to the people from that area.
I actually have recently learned that Germany has a very interesting relationship to American natives, to North American natives, at communities and First Nation communities, and that they severely fetishize them, basically.
That's common in a lot of Europe.
Yeah.
And it's one of the reasons why Hergé did Tintin in America, is because he was all about the, like, North American First Nations people, and it was part of scouting, and they did kind of fetishize them as, like, this idealized versions of themselves.
Mm-hmm. I have heard, from my roommate who lived in the UK for a while, was talking to me about how there's a parallel among how in Europe they might fetishize the native peoples from North America. There's a parallel there in how we perceive the Roma or the traveling people, gypsies, in scare quotes. And we, in our popular culture, have a lot of, like, fetishization of, like, colorful scarves and dancing in the night, and they come and prey on, but we don't realize here, like, that's an actual, like, group of people.
And distinguishing their actual cultural practices and who they are and the things that they have suffered for that identity, because they are another severely, like, oppressed group of people. It's interesting, I was just talking recently with a First Nations performer who had gone over to Germany, and she would do these performances and there would be white people dressed up in, like, feather headdresses and stuff, and, like, talking to her about how much they, really celebrated her culture and thought it was amazing, and she's like, no.
We're all, like, immediately appalled by that, but that happens in America and Canada. Just look at the sports teams that are named after horrible things that I don't even want to say.
Yeah. And how offended the fans are when you suggest maybe changing the name would be a good idea.
Maybe.
Oh, man.
Anyway, so the topic, though, of self-identification of the authors actually, like, had a very strong impact on when I went to go select books. So maybe we can talk a little about our selection process, because I know for me it was, like, I decided I felt like reading a mystery that month, and I was going to read a First Nations Aboriginal Indigenous mystery story.
Mm-hmm.
And I started looking them up, and every time I would go research authors, so these books would come up on lists, and I'd go research the author to find out who they were, and they were all various Caucasians with various connections to these people, ranging from zero to they, like, lived in these communities and maybe had a spouse that was, identified as American Indian or a First Nations or whatever it is, but weren't themselves. And it was so hard. And then I started thinking about, is this because, to what degree is this because the mystery genre is not one that is really connected to their cultural practices and how they tell stories. And am I looking for a type of story that isn't something that would come from their communities in the same way? And basically, I'm trying to get an Aboriginal author to write me a style of story that would come from a Caucasian.
I had the exact same thought process because I also tried to find a mystery novel, and I had the exact same thought process to you. Like, maybe this just isn't a genre that is...
Which doesn't mean that there wouldn't be modern Aboriginal authors writing this genre. Sure. It's just like, am I basically imposing my kind of genre onto their community?
I would have thought it was mostly just not enough Aboriginal First Nations authors in general.
I would totally agree with that.
But I will say I started to read a mystery novel, which was 40 Days Without Shadow, an Arctic thriller by Oliver Truk, who I think is the French journalist that I mentioned earlier. And I really didn't get that far into it. And part of it was I'm not sure how, but it shone through that the author was not a part of that community. It was took place in the northern Finland in the Laplands, and it just didn't sit well with me, the novel, so I abandoned it pretty quickly.
Yeah. How did you find it?
Oh, that would have been a really tough, like, internet searching happenstance process, because I knew what I was looking for. I knew that I was interested in learning more about some of the Native peoples from the Arctic areas, because I didn't know much about that. I knew I was interested in finding, like, a mystery novel or a thriller or something, and, yeah, that was, like, the only one that I found that I could find.
So if any listeners know of good versions of mystery novels or thrillers from First Nations, Aboriginal, or Indigenous author, we'd love to hear about them. But also, if you have any information about, like, the relationship of this genre to the way stories are told, that would be an interesting piece to hear about. Even if you can write whatever genre you want, you probably aren't getting as much support if you're from one of these communities to do so, but and get published. But that's another
issue. I didn't do anything super complicated to do my searching. I went to my local library, and they have a section with Aboriginal content. They have little green stickers, and I went through, I browsed through, picked up a couple things, one of which Amanda had already recommended to me, so that was pretty easy. It was The Lone Ranger and Tonto Fistfight in Heaven. So I finally got a chance to read that, and that was my process.
Did any of you guys actually have any experience with The Lone Ranger beforehand?
I read it in high school.
I'd heard some kerfuffle about...
What is it that you had read?
I read The
Lone... No, the actual The Lone Ranger.
Oh, no. I read Lone Ranger and Tonto Fistfight in Heaven in high school.
No, I just heard the kerfuffle over Johnny Depp playing Tonto.
I can't believe they did that.
And how, like, Tonto means idiot, and so the whole structure...
In what language?
I can't remember.
I went to the exact same library as Megan, because we go to the same community library. And I went and looked at all the green stickers. there was a children's section, First Nations children's books, and I picked out a few of those. I read a couple and also went to the adult fiction section. Well, they're right next to each other, I guess, but yeah, in the First Nations section. And that was basically my process. I don't think I used the catalog too much or the subject headings because they were not that useful.
Because they're awful.
Because they're awful. So I really did a lot more hand searching on the shelves for this one.
Yeah, that was our librarian moment. Librarian angst moment.
Oh, yeah.
The subject headings are
subject headings
adequate.
In the medical databases, also bad. In the,
I think that might be your first problem if you're trying to find a mystery novel. searching through medical databases.
Yeah, I was in PubMed, and I just, like, couldn't find any mystery novels. It was so weird.
I definitely did a paper on trying to search through databases with the various subject headings you could find related to different groups.
You wrote a paper on this?
I did.
You should put it in the show notes.
Oh.
That was shaming me.
Not so confident now, are you?
Grad school work is done.
It's
Let it go.
It's gone. Let it go. But yeah, it's an interesting topic, and one of the other places you can find more about cataloging and librarianship is actually the SS Librarianship episode with Michael Wynn.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely put that
in. I haven't listened to that one yet. I really want to.
We'll definitely put that in the show notes. It's an it's a little more librarian insidery, but if you enjoy that and or are librarians, it's definitely worth a listen.
Yeah.
I just looked up science fiction and like First Nations and various variations on that. Various variations.
In Google, in the catalog?
Yes.
Yes.
Everywhere.
In Novelist.
Not Novelist.
No.
But yes.
Okay.
Lots of places.
Lots of places. And
I found two books.
You were successful.
Ish.
Ish.
Yeah. I also, I did try and find stuff not just from North America as well. So I did look a little at books that would have been from Australia or New Zealand, but I didn't find anything. And part of the reason is just because we do not live there.
Yeah.
All right. And so there's less of a reason for libraries here to have books.
Yes.
I also found that.
True. And also this definitely came up when I was intimidated by the idea of even trying to select something from an Indigenous community author in South America, because I don't understand the shape and structure of these communities and who is there and what are the politics about how they identify and how they intermingle with various Caucasian groups that have come over time. Like, there's a lot of, I understand better the North American context. So it was literally intimidating to me. Although I did look at reading Ira Berta Menchu, which looked very interesting, but more intense than I had the emotional capacity to read. Like, I read the first chapter of it, and I'm like, this is going to be...
I have read Rigoberta Menchu, but I read it when I was in Guatemala, actually.
Oh, really?
So
there are definitely, the definitions of what exists down there are very different, and there are some historical things in certain countries in South America, Central America, that are crazy. One country banned, white people couldn't marry other white people. You had to marry,
You had to intermarry?
You had to intermarry.
Oh.
That was the law.
When?
1700, 1800s? I think 1800s.
Very weird. Oh, yeah, I ran across a nonfiction novel the other day that was about slavery in South America for the Indians who lived there and how that lasted a lot longer.
Yeah. There is a lot of... There are quite a few countries in South America and quite a few different communities down there and a lot of history that I just don't have a good grasp on. Mm-hmm. And so I really did look at that. The other thing that was interesting to me was when I was looking at... I don't remember what text it was I was looking at, but I noticed that it had originally been written in whatever their local community language was, and then translated into Spanish, and then translated into English. And, I'm like, several translations later, what is the shape of this text and the voice of this text, and how many different authors are we reading, and whose story are we reading anymore? But, so, it's not like I could read it in the original language anyways. I can't do that with, many major languages. In fact, any, except for English. So, I mean, that's always an issue. But it was an extra interesting one to see it, multi-level translated to get...
I started to read Bearheart, The Airship Chronicles by Gerald Visenor, which was originally published in 1978 and then republished in a revised edition in 1990. This is seen as a classic, I guess, of Aboriginal First Nations Indigenous science fiction.
Well, that would still be in an era of kind of classic of science fiction.
Yeah.
And that's still feeling out that genre.
But it was, I guess, perhaps the first one that was published, and part of it was actually republished in the other book I read, which was Walking the Clouds, an anthology of Indigenous science fiction. Mm-hmm. So it was well known enough to be reprinted there. It was set in the apocalypse is happening world, and it was a climate change one, and it had some interesting stuff, though I stopped reading when the government man, I believe is the term used, and the government woman had a really unappealing sex scene.
Mm.
And the sex scene was not meant to be, like, arousing or whatever, but it dehumanized the characters and, like, just was weird in a way I was not really comfortable with reading more about. However, I can see it, this was probably done on purpose, mm-hmm. you know, and it's kind of reversing the dehumanization that was done to Aboriginal and First Nations groups. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so the book is told in a very strange style that I kind of had a hard time getting into. I felt there was a lot of repetition in parts of it, and circular stuff, and details I would have expected, such as characters having names, were not necessarily included. But it was about these government men had come to this Aboriginal area so that they could take it back and use the trees and other resources that were there. And they were like, oh no, you kicked us off our original land and gave us this, so you're not kicking us off this land as well.
We heard this story before.
Yeah. So it was very strangely told, I felt. And it was not told in a way I found particularly appealing. Mm. But I did, while I was reading it, I was wondering, like, who is the target audience for this book? Mm. And I'm like, I'm not the target audience, clearly. But other people find this interesting and appealing for probably a variety of different reasons.
Well, I think one of the things interesting there is that discomfort you had with that sex scene and the dehumanization of them. I felt like that was the way in which that interacts with how many Aboriginal peoples have been portrayed in
yep.
Western literature and the way they have been dehumanized in Western literature sort of played into as well in the book of short stories I read, which is A Short History of Indians in Canada by Thomas King. And I really, really liked this book. But I liked the fact that while I was reading it, sometimes it was really, like, pushing buttons and challenging some things. And, like there were times when I had to stop and be like, whoa. That's wow. You said that. Wow. And I enjoyed that. And I also, like, even as I was reading that and thinking that, I'm like, they're still not pushing that hard. Like, this could go so much farther. And I feel like, for me, that worked very well in these stories. But they were also really interesting, well-written.
Mm-hmm. I read the same book you did because you passed it off to me after you read it.
No, I think it was the other way around. You read it first and then passed it to me.
Oh, perhaps.
This is why we have reading parties.
I know. It is.
I just wanted to echo that I had the same sentiments. When I read it, I wrote down that it was very provocative, but also, like, very fantastical.
Mm-hmm.
He comes up with these scenarios that put the characters in backward situations and then just takes them to, like, the logical extreme. And, it totally also made me just sit back and, like, But I would highly recommend it. It's like you said, excellently written.
Yeah. And I think an interesting to note in this one is the fantastical aspects of it. Like, I think I even liked it a little bit more than you, just mostly because of the two of us, I'm the one who's more inclined to like fantastical elements of things. So, like, we can both recognize that it was very well done. But, like, if you're into fantastical stuff, like, this will get you going for sure. But if you're not as into that, it's still well done and it's worth a read and it's interesting and the stories are fairly short and you can get through them easily, but it just might not perk. It might not touch those things you love quite as much.
Yeah, I had a probably similar experience reading The Lone Ranger and Tonto Fistfight in Heaven by Sherman Alexie, because it's also a collection of short stories. There's a lot of, like, dark humor and just stories that make you sit back and have to put them down, or at least I had to put them down and give myself a couple minutes breather before diving into something else. So Sherman Alexie, probably most people know him as the author of The Absolutely True Story of a Part-Time Indian, which is a YA that Amanda has already mentioned, and he's Spokane/Coeur d'Alene from the States. Some of the other things I read included a picture book, kid's book, called The Giant Bear, an Inuit folktale, which is as told by José Agustín Gundrick and illustrated by Eva Witterman. This one was pretty interesting because the style of the narrative struck me as kind of different from what I normally expect from children's books. They didn't seem to be quite the same arc that you're kind of mm-hmm. used to being exposed to when reading a book where there's the ending has a patness to it. Mm-hmm. And this one didn't. And then I realized it was because it was much more like a textual expression of what is actually a told story mm-hmm. and how that is different experience compared to a book that's written as like meant to be written text.
I found that in one of the picture books I read as well, and you put that so much more eloquently than I could have, so thank you.
I didn't feel eloquent, so thank you.
The one I'm referring to is The Son of the Sun and the Daughter of the Moon. So The Son, S-O-N, of the Sun, S-U-N, and the Daughter of the Moon. And I don't know how to pronounce the name, by Anna Wojtek. It's V-O-J-T-E-C-H. And this is a Sami folktale. It's a picture book based on the folktale where the moon is trying to protect her daughter. And at the same time, the sun is trying to find the perfect wife for his son and is eyeing the daughter of the moon. And just like Megan was saying, the ending did not, or the arc of the story didn't follow what I thought it was supposed to go. Like, I guess in reading, you're like, no, it's supposed to go this way. Like, now we have the action, and then we have the yeah. climax, then we have the resolution, you know? And like,
all those expected story beats and yeah. styles of telling a story.
In yeah. the end of the story, the daughter goes...
Spoiler alert!
Spoiler alert!
It's a folktale.
In the end, the daughter goes back to her mother, the moon, and is running away from the son of the sun, and she is still resting in her mother's arms to this day, and she's the shadow on the moon. But I just thought it just seemed like kind of anticlimactic to me as an ending, but I did really enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. Well, folktales do have a very different structure from mm-hmm. what we're used to in reading. But still, yes, I completely understand. Like, yeah.
So the daughter just stays with her mother for the rest of her life. And I was like, what?
It's like...
So it has a lot in common with millennials.
Something ouch. I could really relate to. I read another picture book, which was called The Reindeer People by Ted Lewin. And this was a very simplistic book for really young readers, or even probably a book that someone would have read to them by a parent. So the text was kind of like, meh. But the best thing about this book is it had these amazing watercolor pictures of reindeer in the northern parts of Scandinavia, and I really loved looking at all the pictures.
I did also manage to read a book that was outside of the North American context. As we were saying, it was a little bit complicated, but actually I started reading this before the month began, and I put it down because it was a YA. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that it was actually written by, so it's called The Interrogation of a Shiloh Wolf, and it was written by Ambelin Kwe Molina, who is of the Palikue people of Pilbara in Western Australia. She also teaches law and writes picture books. And then I realized it was a book of wolves, so I picked it back up again and ended up enjoying it despite its...
YA-ness. Which is not to say that we have anything against YA literature. We just have tolerance levels.
Yes. Yeah. We are not the audience, to be honest.
Right.
So this was actually a post-dystopian sort of sci-fi / fantastical story where in order to keep the balance of the world after some destruction has gone on, there's a severe restriction on technology. Computers are outlawed, and
no.
This is definite, like, dreaded nightmare dystopia.
It's a hell dimension.
I'm sure you wouldn't have missed it if you were never exposed.
No, I would.
You would have invented them. Okay, but some people, namely the youth that are part of this specific tribe have powers, and the authorities are afraid that their powers will throw things out of balance and the world will all go to terribleness, so they're trying to repress them. And so Ashayla has been leading this tribe of kids with special powers, and she gets kidnapped, and she's undergoing an interrogation. They're trying to figure out where her bodies are. And so there's lots of drama and stuff like that. It's pretty good. It was nominated for 2 awards. 2 YA awards. So,
not real awards.
So I was also going to mention one I read actually more recently, well after we did this month. But I thought it was a good... It's one I really wanted to mention. So I read Tilly, A Story of Hope and Resilience by Monique Gray Smith. It is a sort of somewhat fictionalized version of her own memoir, based specifically around growing up as the child of of a mother who was taken during the 60s scoop from her Aboriginal parents as an infant. Her mother was raised by a white family and had no connection to any Aboriginal community whatsoever, whether her original one or anything. And then her father, who was only someone in the picture, had been raised in, I believe it was a Lakota family community. And so she knew her grandmother, her father's mother, through that. And her grandmother had had a strong impact on her childhood, but her mother, her parents were not stable. They had alcohol issues. They had, her mother then was a single working mother and worked multiple jobs and wasn't in her life steadily. And she grew more and more angry, and she had struggled with her identity and who am I? And just generally had a very, very upheaval sort of childhood. And in that way, it's sort of an exploration of, like, why something like residential schools or the 60s scoop does not affect just the generation that went to residential school. It affects many generations after that, and there are these ripples that go out, and there are ways in which this this makes various people vulnerable. And it was a great exploration of that, follows her through the story of becoming an alcoholic very young, getting out of that, dealing with her alcoholism, dealing with relationships that are not healthy in her life, finding relationships that are healthy, and trying to strive to find an identity that works for her. And the way she does this is by trying to find more about what Aboriginal roots she knows she has and what connections she has there, and build those and really find strength through those. So it was a really enjoyable read. It was short and fast to read too, but it was very powerful and it was very interesting. And it actually made a very good companion to when I was still in my Master's of Library and Information Studies program here in Canada, because I was coming from the United States and I just did not have Canadian content in my reading background very much. I made a conscious choice to try to read some Canadian content anytime it came up. So I took a class on children's literature, contemporary children's literature. And one of the books I read was My Name is Zepeetza. So that's S-E-E-P-E-E-T-Z-A. And it's by Shirley Sterling. Yes, shush. We had the same...
you were just talking about Canadian content.
Yes, yes. Okay, it's by Shirley Sterling. At least I can spell the O-U's and the R-E's properly now.
That is more important.
That's more important. Sure.
That's how you spelled that. Z-E-R-E-O-U-E.
So, My Name is Sabrina by Shirley Sterling is a story of going to residential school. It is a story of a young girl being taken to residential school and her experiences there and abuse and but it's aimed at a middle grade audience. So it is a, again, a quick read, but a powerful read. And it gives you a good, like, introductory piece to coming into some of this history. So, those are both good, like, kind of good companion reads to
give you some like background information in good stories that are short, very powerful, sometimes painful, but really approachable.
Mm-hmm. One of the other books I read actually had a little bit of a tie-in piece to the issue of adoption, but sort of taking a more healing approach to it. So the book is called Sweat by Leslie Bello, and she's Ojibwe from the Garden River First Nations in Ontario. And she, this book is sort of like, it's a twin narrative between a woman who really wants to adopt children because she lost one, and another woman who becomes pregnant and ends up giving up her twins for adoption, and then a sort of a third stream where it's sort of a mythical, magical realism aspect that sort of ties all the stories together in dealing with, you know, all the issues that come along with that.
Yeah. So,
that was pretty good. I also had a little bit of issues coming into the narrative style, but toughed it out. Appreciated it in the end.
It was worth
sometimes
it.
Sometimes it's worth it just to stick with something that's difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sometimes it's not.
Yeah. Yeah. That too.
Yeah.
That too.
I read a couple additional books. One of them was a graphic novel. And if any of you have been listening to our podcast for a while, you'll know I'm not really a big fan of graphic novels or comics or anything that's, like, non-linear and, like, not words.
How are comics not non-linear?
Okay, how do I put this? Okay, in my head...
This is why I hate Amanda, by the way.
we have issues.
We're sitting as far apart from each other as we possibly
okay,
can in the studio.
That was the wrong word to use, but I'll try and explain.
You're
what
wearing
I
the
mean.
Same colors.
Hey.
She has color.
Color on your head.
We're okay, for reference, both of us are wearing black on black on black. Although Matthew has red hair and I have pink hair.
Totally different.
Totally different.
I think I also have more black clothing than you do.
fight. It's on. It's on, Matthew.
We're going to have a showdown for the next show.
So there'll be a poll in the show notes to see who you think will win.
Okay.
This conversation is now over. You hate comic books. Continue.
They're not a style that works well for me, and I'll try to explain why. Non-linear was probably the wrong word, but I often find I have to go back and, like, reread the bits I've already gone over because I find myself reading the words and not looking at the pictures, and then I miss things. So I have a lot of trouble reading them. It takes more time and energy and, like, processing, like, brain processing in a way that I don't normally use my brain, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I find them really difficult to read because I don't use those muscles, I guess.
Those brain pathways.
Yeah, those neurons are just, like, not connected in a way that allow me to, like, read them efficiently.
So you should read more, is what you're saying.
Quite possibly. It'd probably be good for me.
I wish there was, like, a weightlifting manga that had been translated into English. And then I would recommend that to you.
Yeah, I'm not opposed. Like, I have read some that I like. But I was exploring that this month, and I read Three Feathers by Richard Van Camp and Kay Mateus. I think you also read this book this month, Matthew, didn't you?
No,
Megan.
Me, and I read it after the month. Then okay. I brought it up because you forgot how many feathers.
No, three feathers.
How many children were involved?
Three. One for each feather.
See, you remember now, because I wrote your notes.
No, I wrote my notes.
Is that why there's all those hearts on the page?
Hey.
This could be a lot of weird conversations.
My undying love for Megan, right there. See?
Aww.
Now I got mushy. Yeah, it's a book about restorative justice. The plot is about three boys who vandalized something in the community, and they were sent by the elders to live on land for 9 months as a part of their circle restorative justice process. I found it to be kind of basic and hard to follow. Like, there wasn't actually very much text. A lot of it, some of the squares.
Panels,
thank you. Some of the... Matthew's just head in hands right now. Some of the panels were just pictures with no text, and I would just skip right over them. Like, that's not a thing that...
I think I've discovered your problem with reading.
Amanda,
Let's talk about...
You shouldn't be allowed to read them anymore.
Do you,
Do you ever go to, like, art galleries and look at the pictures?
No,
you
she just texted me.
That's all that matters.
So that was that one. It was a really quick read. I loved the idea of the restorative justice model, partly because I used to work in restorative justice, working with a lot of First Nations families, so that really resonated with me. But I did find the book a little bit hard to follow.
It could have just been a bad comic as well.
I that was one of my thoughts, but like I also can't really judge that not having read like a lot of graphic novels, so I'm gonna leave that to the experts.
Megan, what did you think about it?
It wasn't the most exciting read I've ever had. It was pretty short and basic, so.
But perhaps.
Was it even a graphic novel?
More like a comic.
Yeah,
I thought so. One of the differences, or one of the reasons that it was a little bit of a basic storyline, is that it could have been oriented towards a younger reader. What do you think, Megan?
Oh, that's definitely a possibility, and now that you mention it, I would say probably, yeah, like middle readers.
Was this the one with terrible lettering?
Yes.
Oh, right.
I only remember because you commented on this the last time we recorded the podcast that failed.
It was really poorly lettered.
You commented about the lettering, and I had no idea like what you were talking about.
This was one that was also published in multiple languages.
Okay.
And so, clearly, the lettering had been done in multiple languages.
In terms of comics or graphic novels, what does bad lettering mean? For those of us who have no context.
Generally, you notice it at all.
Okay.
So this is weird, but when I find personally that when you notice the lettering, you only really notice it when it's either really good or really bad. And other than that, it just becomes, how often do you notice the font in books you read?
When they talk about the font at the end of the book and they tell you all about it, the history.
Whenever it's serif.
Design sub.
It's harder to read.
So, traditionally, comics were all hand lettered,
right,
for the most part. But more recently, most things are now computer lettered, and it has added aspects to comic creation and changed a major aspect. I guess imagine if every novel written up until like the year 2000 was handwritten.
Ouch. My wrists are sore. Moving on! Did anybody read anything else that you wanted to talk about?
So I read the anthology I mentioned earlier, Walking the Clouds, an anthology of indigenous science fiction. And this one I wanted to mention because, first, there were stories in this that were not in any way science fiction. In my mind, there was science in them, and they were fiction. But that does not mean it is science fiction.
So it wasn't that they were written long ago and then became true?
No, there was one about somebody watching the moon landing on a television.
That's sci-fi for sure.
The moon landing's in it, right? But it was written after the moon landing.
You know they made that up, right?
Now in our show notes, we have to put some, like, moon landing truthers.
It's all hoax, man.
So this is the last episode of
the Sorry.
There was also some recurring themes of similar to the Bearheart book I read about after, like, the collapse of society or, like, environmental collapse and people going to, like, Aboriginal and First Nations territory because they were better at surviving than, I guess, people in cities after everything horrible happened. But there was one story specifically, or an excerpt from a novel that I wanted to mention, and it's an excerpt from Red Spider, White Web by the Métis author Misha, who I think is just credited as Misha originally on the book, but I think that their last name is Nagha. I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
It will be in the show notes.
Yep. And this was like an early, I think, 1980s, maybe early 1990s cyberpunk novel.
Mm.
And I'm a big cyberpunk fan, theoretically at least. I think I like the idea of it more than the actual works that are produced a lot of the time. And this one specifically was interesting because it was about an artist. And I feel like seeing dystopian cyberpunk future about, specifically, like an Aboriginal artist, seemed really interesting to me. And I've kind of been on the lookout for this one since then, and I've been unable to find it. It's still theoretically in print, but you can seemingly only buy it directly from the publisher.
Oh.
And their shipping to Canada is very expensive. But if any listeners want to mail it to me, I will happily give you my address. Just email us at bookclub4m@gmail.com.
Do you actually monitor that email?
Yes.
I didn't even know we had an email.
That's
valid.
We say at the end of every episode.
Do we get any fan mail?
No.
Oh. You, Anna, pointed me in the direction of the book Two Old Women by Velma Wallace.
Yes.
But apparently it's quite popular in Alaska.
Oh, yes.
And never having lived in Alaska, I'd never heard of this book, but I really enjoyed it. It takes place in northern Alaska. It's a rewritten folktale from that area in which two older women from a band are left behind during a really long winter. And in the story, the two old women, when they were part of the band, they complained a lot, they had aches and pains, and when they were left behind, they found a lot of strength that they didn't know they had, and they found companionship with each other, and so forth. It's an excellently written story. There's a lot of themes of trust, betrayal, friendship, community, forgiveness, as they re-get in touch with the band, and they have to relearn the trust that was severed when they were left behind. So it's excellent. I would highly recommend it. And it's very short. It's like a novella.
So I wanted to mention one that was not written by an Aboriginal person or First Nations person, which is Servant of the Underworld, which is the first book in the Obsidian and Blood trilogy by Aliette de Baudard. She's a French author who is writing in English. This is a fantasy mystery story set in the capital of the Aztec Empire before any Europeans get there. And I really enjoyed it. There were some issues with it, but I generally really enjoyed it. And I've been looking for the next book since then as well.
I just started reading the ebook collection of that.
And it's interesting because this is, I guess when you're writing about something from that time period, you're writing about cultures that don't really exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Which is...
complicated.
Complicated, yeah.
Yeah.
So she did, like, you know, a lot of research, I assume, and it seems fairly authentic. But you've got, like, multiple, like, steps between reality and this novel. So it's kind of strange.
Yeah, that's pretty much on purpose, too. I remember reading how they burnt all the written texts.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh man, I nearly cried.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was such a distressing piece of historical information to take the collected works of some people's culture and just being like, well, burn it. Your culture is useless. You should become Christian now.
Yeah.
It's really upsetting.
It's that line of like what was called assimilation and what is now more
cultural
genocide.
Yeah.
That's what we would call it.
Like colonialism. Yeah, I guess that's the easier way to say it.
Mm-hmm. So,
on that depressing note.
Oh, man. Do you think you're going to read more?
Of
First Nations, Aboriginal?
I've read after this month ended, the original month for this genre, I read a comic about Shanna Dithowit, who was the last Beothuk person in Newfoundland. And that is one where actual genocide happened, and the entire, that entire ethnic group was killed by Europeans. And the estimates of how many of them there even originally were is not very large.
Mm-hmm.
It's like several thousand, perhaps. And they were killed off by being pushed away from their traditional lands, diseases, just getting shot. So I read that comic. I've read some of her before, so it was really just kind of reminding me of it. It's a depressing story.
I would really like to read some more Thomas Keane because I enjoyed those short stories so much. I'm particularly interested in reading The Inconvenient Indian, A Curious Account of Native Peoples in North America.
It's really good.
Yes. So I have heard. I have heard multiple times. But in the meantime, I happened at a book sale not too long ago to pick up a copy of I think Green Grass, Running Water.
Mm-hmm.
So that one's actually sitting on my shelf. So that may happen sooner, but we shall see.
This isn't a genre or topic that I ever really, like, intentionally read, but, I mean, I read individual books when they're recommended to me as being awesome or, you know, I hear about them. Mm-hmm. I don't have anything lined up right now, though.
Well, that's okay. I will say, I happen to have done some work in the last few months and ongoing that has me thinking a lot more about the relations of First Nations people in Canada specifically. Mm-hmm. So it is on my brain a lot more. And the intention is there to read more historical pieces as well, and more pieces from the perspective of mm-hmm. these communities on mm-hmm. what it is like to have gone through the things that they have gone through. But it's awfully hard to do when you're reading when you're reading a lot, finally, mm-hmm. after working multiple jobs for a long time, to read something that is challenging and distressing right now is hard, because mostly I just want to read fluff at the moment. I'm reading a lot of fluff at the moment. And also just because I'm looking ahead at, once again, working at multiple locations, yeah. more than full-time hours, and I'm just like,
It's hard.
It's hard.
Yeah.
I give up other pieces of my life sometimes.
Yeah.
I'm not yep. working in the public library circuit. For me, I'm in health librarianship. It's hard for me to become involved in projects like
yeah.
that. Although at one of my contract jobs, I am doing some medical research on First Nations health, mm. Which has been kind of interesting.
Kind of made it a personal challenge to read at least one per month. I don't know if I've exactly hit that in the 6 months since I started, but I'm doing okay. I've read a couple. I just picked up Skin Room by Sarah Tilley, which I'm kind of looking forward to, because actually this probably won't be relevant when the episode is released, but June 21st is Aboriginal Day. So there's been a whole bunch of displays up there at Surrey which with their content, which I found helpful because it means it's more exposed.
I also read the book War Dances by Sherman Alexie, and I'd read some Sherman Alexie before, but I didn't allow myself to double read, reread things I'd already read, as I thought that probably wouldn't count. The tagline on Goodreads said, "Ordinary men on the brink of exceptional change," and I think that's pretty accurate. It read a little bit similar to A Short History of Indians in Canada by Thomas King. Just interesting circumstances that people found themselves in. All of them were, like, really different from each other and unique situations. I really enjoyed that. Although, I will say, in contrast to some of his other works, I feel like race or First Nations identity wasn't really as strongly portrayed in that book. Some of the stories, it wasn't even clear. I think a few of the stories featured white men, in fact. So,
well, that's a thing. Like, do you have to write it if you are First Nations? Can you only write about First Nations people?
No. Certainly not, of course, of course.
You shouldn't have to do that.
I said in contrast to his previous work, so, I mean, that's kind of what he's known for, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that is another layer to the fact that I made an intention to try to seek out First Nations, Indigenous, and Aboriginal authors. There's always the endless question, who has the right to write about what experiences?
Sure.
And it's a constant question.
Did anybody read any Joseph Boyden?
Nope, I didn't. I picked up Born with a Tooth, I think is what it's called, which is a collection of short stories by him. I read the first one, and then I just didn't kind of make it to the end. I enjoyed that story quite a lot, the first story in the book, but I just wasn't feeling it for reading the rest of them at the moment. I would be very interested in going back. Certainly, he's made quite a splash, and is a well-known name right now mm-hmm. in the Orienda and yeah. other things. But I would be interested in going back for more of those short stories at some point. I'm kind of hoping, like, if the short stories one pops up at some point, that will be high on my list of things that I will grab. But we shall see.
Yeah. Yeah, I picked up Three Day Road and then realized how big it was and put it down again.
Yeah, I know. There was definitely some of that in, like, the selection process, which there usually is. But, like, yeah. No, right now I'm like, What is my favorite urban fantasy? What is some, like, steampunk? What is... Yeah, no, I am all about the fun.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Book Club for Masochists, where we reread all of the books, regardless of our interest in them. You can find us online on Tumblr at bookclub4, as in the numeral, m.tumblr.com, where there are reviews and things that we didn't discuss this episode. Other people also contribute stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We're on Twitter at bookclub4, the numeral again, m, the, at, just that, at bookclub4m. We always screw up the Twitter one. And on Pinterest at pinterest.com/bookclub4m, and on Goodreads, where you just have to search for Book Club for Masochists.
All our opinions are our own and do not reflect our places of employment, if they exist.
We would like to give acknowledgement to the Vancouver Public Library for use of their Inspiration Lab, where we screwed up the sound last time, so we are now re-recording. Any faults with the audio quality are representative of our learning process, so hopefully that has improved.
And our intro music is To Arrakis by Dark Sun, from the Free Music Archive.
Come back next time, where we inflict upon you the genre of... Space Opera!
We'll just use the first one. At least it had some kind of hope in it.
No, there's no hope.
There's no hope.
There's only despair.